GPS tracking, surreptitious harvesting of DNA, and facial recognition cameras. How much privacy should you expect in public places? Professor Buzz Scherer joins me to discuss. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, let's pull together some of the topics we've been talking about the last few weeks on privacy. How far back do laws regarding privacy in public places really go?
Well, they go, whether they talk explicitly about privacy or other laws that effectively deal with privacy in public places. You know, the classic is a body of property law that says when you knowingly abandon something in public, then you give up all rights to it. You have no rights to it. And that was, you know, that's a version of including your, effectively, it appears, your privacy rights. So that's a version of privacy as funneled through a body of property law. But it's always been the case that there's this tension as to whether we should use property law exclusively to think about privacy. And back in the 60s, in a case called Katz versus the United States, the Supreme Court said privacy is not about things or property, it's about people. And so what we really need to be looking at is what an individual's expectation of privacy is in an item, wherever it is. Second, whether that expectation of privacy is deemed reasonable by society. So in Katz, the case was the guy was talking in a phone booth. He had the door closed. Those of us who are old enough to remember phone booths.
What's a phone booth?
And the police put a listening device on the outside of the phone booth and could hear his end of the conversation. So if you think about that case in property terms, they didn't enter the space that he was temporarily declaring his own, the inside of the phone booth, to listen. And if you think about it as a pure property case, there's no violation of his privacy in property terms because they didn't enter anything of his, even though the phone booth was only his kind of temporarily. So, but the Katz court said, wrong analysis. They really changed the frame and said, we don't need to think about this in privacy terms. What we want to do is think about this in, what does he expect? What do you expect in terms of privacy when you go into a phone booth, close the door, and talk to someone? And I think it's easy to say in that circumstance, you expect that the conversation is private. And second, is it an expectation that society would deem reasonable? And I think in that circumstance, it's not hard to say, yeah. So that started the long and tortuous path of thinking about privacy not just in property terms. You know, another case in the 90s, I think it was, is Kylo versus the United States, which is a case involving thermal imaging. The police suspected Kylo of using high-intensity lamps in his house to grow marijuana. They didn't have enough information to go in the house and search the house. That is, they didn't have enough information to show they had probable cause to get a search warrant. Mm-hmm. So they, on public property, they set up a thermal imager to measure the heat emanating from Kylo's house. Again, a straight property law interpretation of that case would say, they didn't enter his house, no violation of the Fourth Amendment right, you know, to privacy. But the Supreme Court, in opinion by Anton Scalia, who is was one of the big privacy judges on the court, very much a libertarian and privacy nut in that regard, Supreme Court said it's up there that he has an expectation of privacy in his house and what goes on in his house, no matter how the police determine it. That is, just because they didn't enter the house, that's not a property violation, obviously, but it still is a Fourth Amendment privacy violation.
Right. So you would need a warrant in order to do something
like
that.
You need to get probable cause, and so you could go to a judge and say, I got probable cause, give me a warrant to search the house. So there's that line of cases that starts to divorce. So part one of this is that line of cases starts to divorce the thinking about privacy in just property terms. Mm-hmm. And it's been going on for, you know, 50 plus years now, ever since the Kylo case. So then part two of this discussion is high technology, new technology,
right,
where you can, if somebody spits on the ground, you can take that saliva and mine that saliva for all the DNA genetic information you want. Right.
Mm-hmm.
If someone drives, parks their car in a public parking lot, you can place a GPS on the bottom of the car and track their whereabouts for 10 days, up, you know, for 10 days or more, and have a chart basically of a person's whereabouts in public for 10 days or more. Information that the police could have gotten just by following this person around, right?
Yeah.
Or with facial recognition, you know, you can have cameras out there and you can take a, you know, have somebody on the camera and you can digitize their, you can turn their face into a digital representation and put it in a database. And use it to, for identification purposes and other circumstances. All information, the saliva, the whereabouts, the face, all information gathered in public. So certainly a property analysis doesn't work.
Right.
So then the question becomes, so do we have any expectation of privacy when we go out in public? And it makes me think about three layers to that analysis, three kind of informal rights. Let's call them informal rights for right now. Three informal overlapping rights that it feels like we still have when we go out in public. One, the right to be anonymous. We shouldn't completely give up our anonymity when we go out in public. We all know that feeling, or many of us love going to big cities who live in the country because we, unlike in, you know, Portsmouth, I've lived there for 25 years, you walk down the street and inevitably you're not anonymous. You know people,
right.
People know who you
yeah,
are.
I grew up in rural Maine. I mean,
right. Everybody
like,
knows
so what,
everybody.
What happened to Bill? Like,
right.
That sort of
yeah, and there's a pleasure in going to a big city and nobody knowing you and being anonymous, there's a freedom associated with that that at least is nice. We'll come back later to whether as a matter of law and constitutional principle we want to recognize that. So that's one. Another is the right to be forgotten.
Right.
You know, can't we just go through life with the world, and particularly the government, not remembering everything about us and compiling everything about us in some kind of database or companies doing that?
Right.
You know, let me just be me and don't log me in to, you know, don't log me in, don't count me in all the ways you do. The most obvious example of that is when you go on the internet, it is breathtaking how well tracked your every keystroke is.
Metadata is a huge consideration when it
comes
to this.
There's a marvelous book on this topic that will just scare the hell out of you, to use the formal term. It's about surveillance capital. And I highly recommend it. You can't read it all at once because it's just too scary. You got to read like chunks of it and
just then start burning your computer.
But it talks about how deeply invested Google and Facebook are in collecting all sorts of behavioral data. They call it behavioral surplus, just by virtue of when you get online, what you do.
Right.
Just leave me alone. Forget about me. Don't keep putting me in every single database and selling it to companies so they can anticipate what I want to buy as I'm in my car and then my GPS is logging in where I'm going and what I'm doing and reporting that to the databases, the many days. So there's that right to be forgotten. And then the third one is, again, these are overlapping, you know, the right to be anonymous, the right to be forgotten, the right to be left alone. Just leave me the blank alone. You know, I don't want a part of this, and I don't want, just because I go out in public, I don't want somebody to pay attention to me, be it by taking my face and putting it in a database, by collecting my DNA, by following me around with technology. My sense is, and this is kind of an idea in progress for me, You know, that the bundle of the right to be left alone, the right to be forgotten, the right to be anonymous, you put those all together, and again, those are overlapping. Mm-hmm. There's something there that says we don't abandon everything when we go out in public, every possible right. We need, there's something that should be preserved for us. But we cannot make it like you give up all of those things just because you go out in public. As is the ultimate question about privacy in many ways when we're talking about the government in possession of this information, which is, and constitutionally, that's all we're talking about, is, you know, is it creepy or is it crafty that the government has all this information? And, you know, there's no easy answer to that. So constitutionally, you know, we haven't really started to think about it in those terms I talked about, because this new technology is just beginning to reveal how much, in theory, we're able, how much in theory the government and commercial entities are able to collect just right. by us going out in public.
And this is very recent when you're, especially when you speak from a legislative or court's perspective. I mean, it's really been, what, the last 40 years that this has really been developing. So usually things like this happen over very long periods of time, so law can develop. I mean, think of how much changes over the has changed over the last 10 years, where now basically smartphones are ubiquitous.
Yep.
Everyone's got a little tracker device basically in their pocket or purse mm-hmm. that they take with them. I mean, there was a...
And what percent of people know what they're doing when
they
do
don't.
That?
They don't. And that was an issue with Google Maps about 5 or 6 years ago. Everyone went, oh, I can see exactly where I went over the last 7 days using the history function of Google. And because of the GPS and Android, you could see everywhere you went if you carried your phone with you.
So interestingly, the GPS hypothetical I talked about is not a hypothetical. It's a real case. U.S. versus Jones. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case where the police put a GPS on the bottom of a guy's truck that they suspected was a drug dealer. And they followed him around for using the GPS for 10 days and collected a wealth of data about his whereabouts. In a messy, messy opinion, there are 5 different opinions. In a messy, messy result, the Supreme Court said you needed a search warrant for following somebody around in public that way. So there's that case out there. You know, there's the backwards cases, the Katz case, standing in public and collecting private information about people in their private places. That's kind of an indirect version of that. The surreptitious DNA harvesting somebody's saliva off a coffee cup that you abandoned in public. I've written a long law review article on that topic. Most of the courts are saying you give it up when you spit on the sidewalk or you leave your coffee cup there. I think they're absolutely wrong, and I don't think they're writing it. I don't think they're analyzing it.
You basically have no choice. I mean, you can't keep all your trash in your house, and you can't. It's literally impossible for you to leave no DNA trace as soon as you leave your house.
So let's talk about New Hampshire. You used the trash reference. In New Hampshire, unlike federally, but like the state of Washington and some other states, if you put your trash in an opaque bag out on the street, on a public spot on the street, to be collected by a private collector or the government, in New Hampshire, you have an expectation of privacy in that trash, and the police need to get a search warrant supported by probable cause to go into that trash. Not in most states and not in under the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's New Hampshire. Now, finally, you know, one of my favorite topics, of course, is Part 1, Article 2B of the New Hampshire Constitution, the new informational privacy right that was created by this constitutional amendment passed that went into effect in December of 2018. So that raises the question that's just going to start to be litigated. Put aside the Fourth Amendment and whether the GPS does count, the putting a GPS on a car in public and following whereabouts, that counts as a search under the Fourth Amendment. Well, what about facial recognition?
Right.
And what about DNA harvesting under an informational privacy constitutional amendment that expands beyond the Fourth Amendment protection? That's new to New Hampshire, but, you know, it's not the face. What is the information that the government is, if the government's collecting that facial information, is it the digitization of the face that is the information, or is your face as it exists in public information as the amendment characterizes it? Are your whereabouts? Is your DNA? I mean, I have a particular take on this. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about very consciously when I wrote Part 1, Article 2B was the surreptitious DNA harvesting, because I'd been working in that area for, 10 years. It's something I've been very interested in. And I think that's clearly covered. You are harvesting genetic information. Even though it's out-of-body DNA and it's in public, you're still entering the cell. And a person, whether they have an expectation of privacy in the coffee cup, which I don't think they do because they've abandoned the coffee cup, they haven't abandoned their expectation of privacy in the cell, in the saliva on the coffee cup, and the DNA in the cell on the saliva in the coffee cup. That's they haven't abandoned knowingly. And that's the Fourth Amendment analysis. It remains to be seen how courts will start to interpret beyond the Fourth Amendment, Part 1, Article 2B. So privacy in public is a really challenging topic. There's not a lot of case law out there. It's going to be, New Hampshire has looked very closely at privacy generally. The garbage case is the classic example. You know, if we, in New Hampshire, the New Hampshire Supreme Court protects garbage left on the street, really? You're not going to protect DNA in a coffee cup? And again, the new factor, Part 1, Article 2B, it's just going to be a really interesting time.
Do you see internationally any countries that are really addressing this? It seems like I'm seeing the opposite more than anything else. What China's doing, obviously, is far from what most people in the United States would ever want to see.
In Europe, they've been more aggressive. The European courts have been more aggressive about thinking about the right to be forgotten and some of those kind of things, the right to anonymity. So,
but London, isn't it like completely covered in cameras?
Yeah, it is. You know, it's
hypocritical to me is what it looks
like.
Well,
you know, it depends on how you look at things. Is your whereabouts different than your genetic information, different than your face, all of which are out in public? Mm-hmm. Should we treat those three differently, or do they all fit under the same umbrella? I mean, that's some of the stuff we're going to have to figure out as a constitutional matter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, legislators are going to start passing statutes, like San Francisco passed an ordinance banning facial recognition. New Hampshire will likely have before a facial recognition statute coming up this session. So the irony of it is the GPS case, this is kind of maybe an interesting place to stop. Are police departments recognizing this issue? The irony of the U.S. versus Jones case, the GPS case, is the police department had gotten a warrant supported by probable cause to put the GPS on the bottom of the car. But under federal law, you have to execute the warrant within 10 days. They put the GPS on the bottom of the car on the 11th day, so they couldn't use that justification. The warrant was no longer active, so they had to go under the Fourth Amendment. So even then, I mean, that was 7 or 8 years ago now. Even then, the police were saying, let's be safe. Let's get a warrant.
And then they screwed it up.
But so it's one of the delicious ironies of that case.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.